Yeah, baby. It's episode 155 of Ask the Inspector on April 30th, 2024. Jeff Norman with Scott Ritter. And that opening was a bit of false advertising because Yelena is out today. Ryan Milton stepping up to the plate heroically to fill in. So a big thank you to the very muscular, very bald, yet strangely effeminate Ryan Milton. How you doing, Scott?
I don't know why Ryan puts up with that, but that's okay. I'm doing
well. If I were saying that about you, would you be threatening to give me a knuckle sandwich?
There would be no threats about it, Jeff.
You would just do it?
There'd be no threats. I would deliver on a promise.
Oh, my gosh. Are you really that tough if you can't take a joke?
No, I don't. I admit I'm not that tough. I have thin skin. There are red lines, you know, and my lack of toughness will show out by other forms of toughness, I guess.
All right. Jeff Norman with the very, very masculine Scott Ritter, former chief UN weapons inspector, extremely tough guy. Don't even think that it might be otherwise.
But see, when you overplay it like that, it's just as bad, man. It's just as bad.
Was it so bad you might give me a knuckle sandwich?
I'm not a violent guy, Jeff. I'm an old man. I have arthritis. Oh. These knuckles don't work like they used to.
All right. Plus, we have a considerable distance between us. So. Hopefully, by the time I see you in
We just aren't going to let, you know, strangely effeminate insults get to
I know where you live, Jeff.
All right. All right. Take it easy. Take it easy. Shall we get to the questions from our live audience?
There is a Substack coming. I've been horribly, I have to apologize to two outlets. One is Consortium News and Joe Loria. Joe, it's not your fault, man. I have had a combination of writer's block and just too much damn podcasting, and I just haven't gotten the product done that I said I was going to do. And then the other one is RT. Yes, I do write for RT, but I didn't write for RT this month. Not because RT didn't want me to write. I just, again, have been suffering under not writer's block per se, but too much activity. And so what happens when you have like six writing projects going on, none of them get done because you're trying to get them all done and nothing happens. So I have got to figure out how to become more productive. And
time management. You need to excel better at time management.
Well, I suck at time management. But anyways, I did manage to...
Are there any more personal messages you'd like to deliver? You know, maybe you have the wife pick up some groceries. You know, this is...
It is my goddamn podcast, so I can do anything I goddamn want to do on this goddamn podcast. So I'll deliver as many freaking personal messages as I want.
Who said that you shouldn't?
You apparently are saying...
Oh, you're imagining I was
eating,
being sarcastic.
I'm eating into the time. But anyways... I do have a Substack that's coming your way, Jeff. So,
all right. Very good. Now that we got that hostility / love, or as Carol Leifer once said, we have a love-hate relationship minus the love part. Let's get to the questions from our beloved audience. This is the lightning round, which means Scott Ritter, William S. Ritter Jr., Macho, former chief weapons inspector, will answer each and every question in 3 minutes or less. Join us Friday night for the loquacious version. 2 hours of glorious, extensive answers from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern time. The first question comes from AJ Welding in South Australia. Some time ago, I recall you noting Niger as a possible hotspot for U.S. NATO versus Russian tensions. Then it has been seemingly quiet. Besides this base 201, are there any updates?
America's out, Russia's in, Russia wins. There's your update. You know what I mean? It doesn't get any more decisive than that. The United States blinked, Russia didn't. Niger has a Russian... Africa Corps members on their soil. They're getting ready to move into base 201. The U.S. is moving out of base 201. victory for Russia. The 30-second update.
Okay. And if you want a little bit more from the weapons inspector on the subject of Niger, you can go to scottritter.com and take a look at his latest video commentary, or not, or one of his latest ones. That was one of three that Scott did last week. But don't do it until tonight or tomorrow, because actually that URL isn't working. We are in the process of launching a new website. So let's say by tomorrow, for sure, that should be working. If you want to submit your questions to us, the way to get for sure it'll work is use scottritter.us for just another day or so. So once again, truth in advertising, not exactly what it should be. Next question. Well, why don't we take a voicemail message, because this is kind of a breaking news story from Turla. Well, the story isn't from him, but it's a question from Turla Irwin in Ireland about a breaking news story.
How are you, Jeff? How are you, Scott? This is Turla from the broken Republic of Ireland. I was wondering if you could try and explain what happened at the ICJ today. Germany's defense seemed to be that Nicaragua had no jurisdiction, and neither did they have any evidence, or the flimsy evidence, despite the fact that Seven Dagdanen, the German parliamentarian the other day, told us how much they have been sending, and how could they have no jurisdiction when a signatory of the convention behoves every country in the world should be on Israel's case, and every other case of every other country that's supporting this genocide.
To be honest, I haven't been following the ICJ today, so I'm not familiar with any aspect of this update, and I'm not prepared to answer the question. So we're going to have to put that dreaded asterisk next to it. And on Friday night, I promised the broken Republic of Ireland that I will answer that question. But I've been knee-deep in Georgia, which is blowing up as we speak. Real potential for another Maidan, a civil war. Bad time violence. And because Georgia is, of course, a very important nation to me because of my marital relations, I've just been focused on that. In fact, tomorrow night, I did an interview today on the Scott Ritter Show, and tomorrow night we'll be airing it. It's an interview of a Georgian politician and political scientist about this very issue. And I think everybody would find it of interest.
Asterisk. All right, that's at 9 p.m. tomorrow night on Rumble, Twitch, Locals, and X.
Yeah, the asterisk list is long now. Well, yes, that's the problem with Ask the Inspector. Sometimes the inspector doesn't know.
Henry in Rochester, what is your response to those who say these college protests against Israel's massacre are nothing more than another round of BLM protests?
Well, I guess we'd have to know what is meant by another round of BLM protests, meaning protests that flame out, go away, or protests that have no merit. And I'm not being critical here. It's just that's an important aspect of the question.
I can make a suggestion what he might mean, because I've heard others say it, that there are outside agitators coming in. These aren't necessarily college students.
I'd say fuck off and die. These are college students on a college campus exercising their constitutional right of free speech and freedom of assembly. And no, I'm not buying into it. Could there be outside agitators? There's always outside agitators. I'll make the following bet. I bet there's more federal informants and infiltrators than there are outside agitators. But I will bet that the vast majority of the participants are college students who are legitimately motivated by their beliefs and the insult that they believe is taking place regarding U.S. policy and Israeli policy on Gaza today. So no. And I'll also say this about the BLM. Look, I wasn't a big fan of the BLM movement, not at all. But they had every right to do what they're doing. And anybody who thinks that was fake, no, fuck off. It was real. There were people who were really pissed off about what was going on. I don't agree with them on many things, but I respect their right to be legitimately pissed off. And to think that somehow this whole BLM thing was simply it's an insult to the American people to say that when a certain group of people get pissed off about something, they're automatically hijacked by outside agitators. That's not how it fucking works. All right. There's always outside agitators on both sides of the argument. There's people who take advantage of things of this nature, but to sit there and paint the entire movement that way, I disagree with that wholeheartedly. I think that the vast majority of the people, and I'll tell you the reason why I believe this, because my daughter was one of those fuckers out there doing the BLM thing. And anyone call my daughter an agitator, I'll knock your fucking teeth out. Okay, she believed in what she was doing. I disagreed with it. We had civil comments about it. We love one another. I respected her dearly for it. I remember calling her when she was outside the White House, and I was watching the TV, and I was watching the cops start to move, and I called up on the phone. And I said, "Hey, look, as a guy who spent a lifetime looking at overhead imagery and predicting outcomes, you're about ready to get rushed by the cops. Get the fuck out of there." "What, Daddy?" "Get the—" I said, "Move." And they literally moved literally right ahead of the horses coming in, the tear gas coming in and all that. But she was on the front lines doing what she believed in. She believed in that cause. There was no outside agitator.
Reclaiming my time, sir. Reclaiming
my time. Reclaim your— I hate that. See, now
enough said.
And just grab that voice and break its head off. Anyways, no, I don't believe in outside agitators dominating this. There's always outside agitators, always people seeking to take advantage of a situation. But I believe that the vast majority of the students out there protesting and the vast majority of BLM people believe in what they're doing, whether I agreed with it or not.
Well, I hope that that's what he actually meant, because you really cut into him as if he did mean that, and I'd feel badly if he didn't. But on the other hand, he was kind of vague about his comparison to the BLM protest, so that's the best we could do.
I wasn't cutting into him. I was cutting into the question. I mean, the concept. I'm not blaming him. It's a good question. Please don't take the fact that I'm really in a bad mood today. I'm trying to smile through this one, Jeff, but we're working on it.
All right. Don't be heinous or odious. Cassandros in Wisconsin. "I read on the most reliable source, Wikipedia, that Israel has nuclear landmines. It cited Seymour Hersh, so I'd assume it's at least somewhat reliable. Are nuclear landmines practical or even real?"
Well, they're definitely real, and depends on what your determination of practical is. I don't like nuclear weapons in general. I don't believe it's practical to use a weapon that's going to contaminate the earth and potentially precipitate a larger nuclear conflict that can kill all mankind. But I'll tell you, growing up in Germany in the 1980s, when you drove through parts of Germany, you got to the Autobahn, you get to these intersections where the Autobahns came across, you look down at the culverts, and they had these places that were giant holes ready to go in. And I was like, "What is that?" "Well, that's where you take the atomic demolition, put it in there, and you blow it up so that this entire highway network goes down and blocks Soviet advances." We designed them, atomic demolition munitions. You could call them giant landmines. People have been talking about using nuclear weapons as giant engineering things, and there's a whole concept that they have for this canal that's supposed to bypass the Suez Canal, the Ben Gurion Canal or something, where they're going to blow up a whole bunch of atomic demolitions of landmines to create this new canal. A nuclear weapon's a nuclear weapon. Whether you use a primitive gun design for an atomic munition, or use it for an artillery shell, you use it for something else, doesn't matter. Once you have a nuclear design, how you employ it, whether it's a landmine delivered by artillery, delivered by aircraft, it's up to you. But does Israel have a stockpile of nuclear landmines? I'd say no. It's a waste. I'd say what Israel has is a nuclear capability that can be that could be configured. Some of which could be configured as a atomic demolition munition, but that's it.
All right, I'm looking at three people on hold here, Scott. These phone numbers look suspiciously familiar. We got to get some new blood in here. I don't know how to manage that situation, but let's give it a shot. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Scott. It's Mark here from Dublin.
Oh, Jesus.
Hello, Mark from Dublin. How are you?
Top of the morning.
I've got my finger. I have my finger on the button, Mark.
Oh, look, it's your show. It's your choice. But I have a question. The Netanyahu goes on about anti-Semitic and stuff like that all the time. But when you look up in the dictionary the word Semitic and the people who are Semitic, it has more than one meaning, as in more than one people. I'm curious the fact that no one actually points this out. And it's an interesting point to look at.
Well, I mean, I actually, people do point it out. I've pointed out on occasion that, the Palestinians are Semites by definition. And then some people go even further to point out there's this whole concept of, Jeff, forgive me for what I'm about to do, Jeff. Forgive me, okay? Because what I'm about to say is just as bad as talking about Building 7. I'm opening up a freaking door that I shouldn't open up. But the Khazarite kingdom in Ukraine, and the concept that many Jews aren't Semites because it's a religion that transferred over to an ethnic group that has nothing to do with the original Israelis. I'm just saying that. I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying it's out there. So I think we have to be careful that a strict term of anti-Semitism isn't what people mean when they talk about anti-Semitism. That the concept of Semite has been transformed away from what it's supposed to mean purely Israel, Jews, and that. And so anti-Semitism now has been captured, that term, to mean anti-Israeli or anti-Jewish in general. They've ruined the term, and they've hijacked it and brought it in for purely political purposes. It has nothing to do with the, here we go, tricky word, etymological. Is that right, Jeff? Did I just say that right? Etymological?
Sure, why not?
I think that has something to do with words and the meaning of words or the sources of words. It's a lot of syllables, more than any Marine should be asked to say on a Tuesday afternoon. But semi-different languages, that's what I'm saying, but that's not what's being used today. When they say anti-Semite, they're not saying all that. They're saying purely anti-Israeli, anti-Jewish.
All right. Speaking of extra syllables.
Commit this hyenas crime.
Hyenas. That's the proper
pronunciation of the word is heinous.
Heinous. No, it's any way we want. The beauty of being an American is that we have a God-given right to butcher any language, any way we want, with a smile on our face, because we don't mean harm. We simply are trying to communicate. And as a result, we butcher things poorly, but we're not doing it to insult anybody. We're not doing it even out of ignorance. We're just doing it because we're really making a wholesome effort to communicate to people. So forgive me if I mispronounce words. I'm not doing it on purpose, whether it's English, Georgian, Russian, or any other language I attempt to speak.
Why don't you go outside and play hide and go fuck yourself?
Well, there we go.
That is a very novel concept of national pride. But you know what? I'm going to play along. I'm with you on that one, Scott. Kenneth from Norway, who you remember when you were visiting me in North Carolina and I was telling you I hate it when people write things that are supposed to be capitalized in lowercase letters.
Right.
And I was feeling a little guilty, like maybe I'm like I have like a get off of my lawn kind of cranky guy attitude. But you sympathize with me, as I recall. You kind of agreed it's annoying.
Jeff, and I had no choice but to sympathize with you because you still help us drive tickets.
I fixed up. This guy almost didn't use this question because he wrote everything in lowercase. And not only that, he didn't even put an apostrophe in I'm. He wrote lowercase I-M, no apostrophe. Oh, it enraged me. All right, I'm calm. You think Scott gets angry? You should see me when I see
Jeff get angry at the all caps, man. It was ugly. Pour him a bottle of wine.
I'm getting really tired of hearing the talk of Mr. Stoltenberg about how we support Ukraine. We will prevail. Russia's on its last leg, etc. How big will the eventual fall of NATO be when Russia has succeeded in its objective?
That's a drum beat. You do that when you're anticipating a dramatic announcement. I have just signed a contract with Clarity Press to publish two books. So it's two contracts. One's with Anya Kay, and we're publishing a book that's based upon the interviews that she has done with me about the "You're Such a Yarbrough Yobo." I have no idea what that is, but that's, I hope it's good because it's from Angel First Leah. I don't know, man. I got to look up the word. But Anya and I are going to put out a book, are putting out a book. We've finished it up. It's basically the war in Ukraine, the Scott Renner interviews through the eyes of Anya Kay. Through the eyes of Anya Kay is the name of her YouTube program, and I encourage everybody to subscribe to it and follow her. She's worthy of that. And that book hopefully is coming out soon. But in addition to that, I have committed to a larger project called Ukraine and the End of NATO. And this is my way of answering the question, because in that book, I'm going to be answering exactly that question. And I don't want to give away the ending, except I'm going to say NATO is going to fall, and they're probably going to fall within 10 years after the end of the Ukrainian conflict. But I will expand upon that in great verbosity. Can you say verbosity when you're writing? You can't say that, can you? Can you be verbose when you write?
Well, why not just stick with loquacious, since it's done so well?
Loquacious is spoken too. I mean, that's a spoken word. What do you say when you write too much?
Wordy.
Yeah. I write books that are very wordy sometimes, but I'm putting that book out, and Ukraine and the End of NATO. And I think the time now is to write it. I'm working with the publisher on the due date of the book because I want some flexibility. Diana Collier, if you're watching, I need some flexibility on this one because we don't want to commit to a narrative that gets overcome by events, but we also don't want to be held hostage by the events themselves. But we need some work in the fall so I can feel how this thing's going before I can say now's the time to say that's the cut. We did well with Deal Breaker. And I think we'll do well with this one too. But anyways, those are two exciting announcements, I think. One of which will voluminous Crypto AG with the word of the day, voluminous.
And Scott's most recent book is on sale at scottrittermerch.com. The author himself, the very macho author, has signed his name, autographed it in a most masculine fashion. So you can go to scottrittermerch.com. I haven't had anybody give me the finger on this podcast since Kevin Michalizzi. Remember Kevin?
I do. Since we're talking about writing and all that, how big are my biceps? Eli, you'd be very disappointed. I need more work in the gym. So I'm not as brave as Ryan is right now. I'm not going to, put them up there. They need more work. So I got to work on it. Anyways, I wrote Iraq Confidential a while back, and that was the book about my work as a weapons inspector. And I submitted the first manuscript. It was to a British publisher, publishing house, Ivy Taurus. And I think the first manuscript I wrote at came in at like 350 pages. Prolific. That's a positive thing. When you say prolific, that's normally positive. Sometimes people accuse me of being sort of anti-prolific, meaning too many words. But so I submitted this thing, and the publisher came back and he said, "It's great, but Scott, you got to breathe life into it. You got to tell me the story. You got to say the way it was." And I went, "Oh shit, okay." So I turned around and I turned in a manuscript that was 700 pages. I breathed a lot of life into that. That put some CPR into that baby. And I breathed, and it was all good stuff. And he came back and he said, "This is brilliant. This is the best writing you've ever done. Wonderful. Now give me 350 pages. So basically I had to go through and rip out really good stuff. I'm trying to capture at least some of that. Recapture it in another book that hopefully come out eventually called The Scud Hunters, which is my story about during the Gulf War, and as a UN weapons inspector specifically focused on hunting Scuds. But that one's got to go through a pre-publication security review by the United States government. And sometimes that can take a long time. So that's why I'm committing to these other books, because I wanted to get Scud Hunters out there, but I'm going to turn that manuscript into the U.S. government, and I may die before I approve it, because
all things considered, would you say that writing is a painful process?
Yeah, I didn't think it was going to be this painful. I mean, I love to write, but it's the first thing I learned writing is that I don't know how to write. I mean, I always knew how to write. I could write good college papers and all this stuff, but I wasn't trained as a writer. There's people who take classes on writing and all this stuff. All I did is read books, and then I captured a writing style of whatever I read and tried to apply it to what I was doing. And maybe if I had been formally trained and I could fall back upon, formal, this is what you're supposed to do in these situations. But I just write, and
You have a real gift for when you're speaking. You have a real gift for metaphor.
That's the problem, is that I write too much. I mean, I sit down and I just go get going. And next thing I know, I've wasted an entire day writing about something that really I can only use two paragraphs of it. And so then I have to go back and rip that apart. And I have to tell you, when you commit that much time to writing something and you put your heart and soul into it, it hurts to sit there and go, eh. So I have a whole computer full of half-written shit that I sometimes I go, oh my God, I wrote something about that. I could go pull that out and update it and use it. But no, most of it's just dead bodies that are sitting in my computer. Things that I started, things I cut out, things that I didn't use. It hurts. It's painful. And the other thing is the way I write, in order for me to write, I have to do a whole bunch of research. If I'm going to do a big writing project, I'll take days to do the research. Then I have to organize the thoughts. Then I have to sit down and literally spend 2 hours or so getting the narrative in my head, what I want to say, how I want to say it. And then I sit down and I start typing, and then the phone rings. It's my wife. Hey, Scott, could you run and get some milk on the way home?
I knew that's what I said earlier. I knew you wanted to get that message.
And I'm like, God damn it. So then, honey, I'm going to get the milk. But now that happened, and I have to hit reset and redo the narrative. And then I sit down, and then it's the phone ringing again. Hey, Scott, it's Jeff. You son of a bitch. What do you want? That coin photograph you promised me last week. Do you have that for me? Oh yes, Jeff, I have that freaking coin. I'll get it to you. And the boom, phone rings. Oh, and the phone ringing and the dogs barking interrupt my writing. And what I really need to do, that I always used to make fun of writers that say, I had to go on sabbatical. So what do you mean go on sabbatical? I went away to this place, and for six glorious weeks, I was in a cabin with no interference, and I wrote so much. And I'm like, get out of here. I'm beginning to like that idea of disappearing for 6 weeks in a cabin with no phones and nothing and just writing.
That could work. Well, I hope the audience noticed that right after I said you have a gift for metaphor, you referred to your unpublished works as dead bodies. So dead there bodies. You go. Next question is not from Ken in Norway. Peo in London, do you see Russia or North Korea agreeing to expose themselves to total
annihilation?
I think I left out a syllable. By agreeing to get rid of their nuclear arsenal, the only thing that stops NATO and or the U.S. from full-scale war against those countries.
No, not at all. I mean, Russia's never going to get rid of their nuclear weapons unless it's part of a global zero thing. And even then, the fact that the collective West has threatened to bring their, collective conventional military capacity to bear against Russia to defeat Russia strategically, it only reemphasizes to Russia the importance of having a strategic nuclear deterrence. Sadly, we're making, nuclear disarmament all but impossible. North Korea is never going to give up their nuclear weapons now. We had a chance under Donald Trump, but Mike Pompeo and John Bolton stabbed him in the back. And now Joe Biden, you know, North Korea is willing to talk. Joe Biden didn't pick up that baton. And now North Korea has a strategic nuclear deterrent that has successfully held the United States at bay. So why give that up? And the big fear right now is Iran. You know, what is Iran? I think it was on this program or the show. I said that an Iranian legislator had put out a post that talked about Iran was prepared within a matter of days to build a nuclear weapon. It turns out that I was guilty of failing to do my due diligence, and that somebody told me that that website that that post on was a fake one, and that that didn't really happen. So I have to reverse on that. But it doesn't mean that Iran doesn't have the capability. I mean, I think though the consensus is with the advances they've made in enrichment and with their with a significant stockpile of 60% enriched uranium that they could within a matter of days, if not a week, you know, create enough highly enriched uranium to produce 1, 2, 3 nuclear bombs. So even though the Iranian government hasn't made a statement in that, or somebody in the government hasn't made a statement, in fact, the belief is they still have that capability, which is what made that statement believable, because it was like, well, yeah, that's sort of, you know, it goes along with what I understand the Iranian capabilities to be, but I've always worried about Iranian intent. It appears that the Iranians haven't made any sort of intent-based statement like that, so I have to reverse on that and be more careful in the future about referring to things I see on the internet. You'd think I'd have learned that lesson a while ago, but there we go.
All right. Let's take an international phone call. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. From whence are you calling?
Hi, Jeff. My name is Jack. I'm calling from Amsterdam. And yeah, thank you for accepting my call, man. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, Jack. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good. So here's my question. Okay, if the ICJ rules that Israel is definitively committing genocide against in Gaza, what kind of sanctions do you think the European Union would realistically impose on Israel? Are they going to go all out to stop them from committing genocide? What do you expect? Thank you.
Well, thanks for the question. I don't know if the European Union is capable of doing something that represents such a breach against the strategic national interests of the United States as manifested in official U.S. government policy. Because when we speak of the United States in this case, it has to be in terms of U.S. government policy, because a whole bunch of college demonstrators, accompanied by a handful of agitators, who are out there, you know, speaking out against this policy. But and Germany is a problem too. I mean, the European Union is a consensus-driven operation, and Germany will never, ever go against Israel. I mean, they've made a decision that because of their past sins, they will not criticize Israel, even when Israel is committing sins that are in many ways similar to the sins that the Germans committed against them. So I don't see the European Union as an entity imposing sanctions at all on Israel. I do see individual nations acting individually and putting sanctions on Israel. And there's a chance that enough nations will do that, that the sanctions actually carry some weight. But I don't see the European Union acting in concert against Israel.
I don't know how to pronounce that name, but that human is from Serbia. I am curious, what's your opinion about this video?
It's not the victory John wants. I've been saying we should go into on the ground. We should announce there's going to be American casualties. We should go to Belgrade, and we should have a Japanese, German-style occupation of that country.
Well, in my opinion of that video, it shows that Joe Biden's one of the greatest warmongers that ever walked the face of the earth. You know, he's a man who didn't have the courage to go in the military himself. He's lived off the military service of his son, Beau. Somehow implying that because Beau, who was the Attorney General of Delaware, not a good lawyer, but he became the attorney general because of Joe Biden, because Joe Biden owns Delaware. And Bo went to Iraq as a lawyer, sitting on his ass back in the rear with the gear while everybody else was doing stuff related to communications. But he came back with a Bronze Star Medal for doing jack shit. But Joe Biden then gave him the highest award for military service that the Delaware National Guard could do. And they named a whole damn place after him because Bo Biden was the biggest fucking war hero that ever walked the face of Biden's godforsaken earth. And then he died of cancer. And then, you know, Biden couldn't let him die of cancer. So he linked it to, you know, the pits. My son was smelling the pits and, you know, got cancer in Iraq, from Iraq. No, who knows? But, you know, fuck off, Joe. Joe Biden doesn't have the courage to serve in the military, never did. And they sitting there talking big about putting boots on the ground, a Japanese-German style spaceship. Belgrade. What he was trying to do is, dog was pissed off as I am right now at the concept of Joe Biden, so they're barking to death. I don't know what's going on out there. Something's happening. But my point is, no, this is just Joe Biden being Joe Biden. I mean, he wanted to bomb Iraq. He wanted to bomb Iran. He wants to bomb everybody. He's, you know, loose and free with the military stuff. You know, put your son in the fucking infantry, Joe. Tell him you're not going in the goddamn adjutant corps. You're not going to sit on your ass in the rear. You're going to fucking go on the front line. You're going to lead the charge, bayonet charge. You know, then I'd have more respect for it, especially if Joe did it himself. But no, that wasn't Joe Biden's style. He's just a pompous asshole who sits there and promotes war nonstop. And I despise the man for it. That attitude towards Belgrade was despicable. Again, I just want to reiterate that there's a wonderful book out. I really do want to promote this book, so I'm going to do it. Take advantage of the stage that I get to have influence on. And the name of the book is Verified on the Ground with the Kosovo Verification Mission. And it was written by Mark Schifanelli. He's a retired U.S. Army Special Forces guy. And it's about basically the U.S. and OSCE and European observers in Kosovo leading up to the war. And he gets into what was really going on. And the reason why I bring that up is once you understand what was really going on, you realize how complicit Joe Biden is. You know, we hung war criminals by the neck until dead after World War II for the crime of promoting, you know, offensive wars of aggression. Joe Biden just sat there. There was no legality for this. He's talking about a Germany, Japan style occupation service. There's no legality for it. There's no international law that allows it. Take Joe Biden, hang him by the neck until dead. He is a war criminal. Oh, goddamn right, Joe. I hate Biden. It's a personal vendetta, too. You want to know why it's a fucking personal vendetta? Because he's a piece of shit who lies through his ass. I spent a lot of time working on the disarmament of Iraq. A lot of people spent a lot of time doing it. And we put a lot on the line, including our lives at times. Fortunately, we never died, but, you know, we were staring down enough barrels of loaded weapons, you know, daring the Iraqis to shoot us. You know, making sure that we didn't back down so that we could finish our mandate of disarmament. And then they had that motherfucker sit there and lie about it. He knew what the fucking truth was, and he chose to lie and disregard the truth about weapons of mass destruction. When he was the co-chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he could have held a hearing, had a genuine hearing, brought up real witnesses like myself, and told the truth to the American people, but he whitewashed it, told a lie to rubber stamp a war, and thousands of Americans died. So do I have a personal vendetta against Joe Biden? You're goddamn right I do, and you better too, motherfucker, because if you don't, you're the wrong kind of human being. Sorry, Jeff, I told you I was in a bad mood.
Because I invested in Family Farm, led by my Secretary of Agriculture, who knows more about this than anybody I know. We're better able to stay in the family.
Fuck you.
And their children and grandchildren won't have to leave.
A double sound clip, Scott. Did you notice a two at once?
You're a very clever man today. I don't know if that was on purpose or if that was...
No, it was on purpose. It was on purpose. I'm doing some very advanced mixing here. Well, let's do another phone call. This person's been on hold forever through the last three episodes because I know they've called before, but they're so damn persistent. Hello, you are going to win an award for persistence, but please be concise. How you doing?
Thank you. My question is, do you think that the Russian will finally destroy the bridge over the Dnieper River to prevent, to hamper the logistics of Ukraine. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Jeff, you found somebody who actually listens to you. You said be brief and concise, and he was. That was a brief, concise question. He wins the brief and concise award.
He was breviloquent also.
Not damn too many syllables.
Breviloquent.
All right. Look, if Russia wanted to take out that bridge had been taken out already. It's not as though the bridge can't be taken out. Russia's not taking it out for a reason, because Russia's not at war with Ukraine, and Russia's not seeking to totally wipe out the critical infrastructure of Ukraine. That being said, if Ukraine, you know, since I've already sworn I violated the Siri mandated do not use the F word thing, I might as well just keep going on a roll. Fuck around, find out. If Ukraine wants to fuck around, they'll find out. You know, I can't predict what the Russians are going to do, but I think if the Ukrainians are dumb enough to think that attacking the Crimea bridge is a good idea, you know, third time's the charm. I mean, they've done it twice, and this time it, you know, they've got new weapons and they're all anxious to be seen as, you know, studly and all this. I also think that Russia's made some political decisions recently that weren't in force before about how they see this war ending, such as not going to go the negotiation route the way that Russia was trying to do early on. This is why the Russians are talking about that process, because they're letting the world know what an opportunity was missed. The Russians are very reticent about talking about ongoing negotiations. They actually respect the you know, the confidentiality of conversations held by negotiators and presidents. They get mad at the United States when they release transcripts of conversations that are held between presidents or conversations related to negotiations. So when, for the Russians to come out and talk about this, to me, it's sort of a sign that says that's part of the past. We're not going to get involved in that anymore. We're going to end it differently. And I think the differently is, the choice that Ukraine has. You can either be preserve as much as possible so that when you join the Russian, Belarusian, Ukrainian Union, which I think is the solution, you have a lot of good infrastructure. Or you can fuck around and find out. And they'll drop a whole bunch of shit, and Russia will take the good stuff, incorporate it into Russia, and leave a pathetic little Ukrainian rump state that's still going to join Russia and Belarus as a union, but this time without any economic infrastructure, without any economic viability, and the Ukrainians that live there are going to be a bunch of local yokel farmers whose product nobody wants to buy. It's up to Ukraine to decide, but Russia kept those bridges up for a reason. We'll find out if the Ukrainians fuck around and find out, and then Russia drops those bridges.
All right, some very salty language from the Marine veteran.
Fuck the fucking fuckers.
You know, Jeff, we got to be careful, because I thought we were trying to build up a Chinese audience. And I thought the Chinese were, like, you know, very proper people. And I love them.
Last people we have to worry about. They won't even understand it.
They will. They're smart, Jeff. They speak better English than I do.
Ni hao.
Ni hao.
NADS in the USA. That's obscene too, but I won't get into that. Is Hamas accepting the Israeli ceasefire proposal a sign that Hamas is genuinely fearful of a Rafah invasion?
Did they accept it? I mean, I have to check. The last time I heard that the Israeli ceasefire proposal was only for 40 days and that Hamas turned it down. But NADS, when did NADS submit that question? Is that a recent question?
Well, it wasn't like today. It was at least a few days ago, I think.
Because today, I think I'm actually up to speed on this one. And I saw that that Hamas turned it down because it was only a 40-day ceasefire proposal. And at the end of 40 days, Israel was going to go in and take out Rafah anyway. So Hamas is like, fuck you. So but we'll find out. We'll put a semi-asterisk on this one.
A semi-asterisk?
That means asterisk. That if I answered the question correctly, we're just going to let it be. But if I didn't, I'll have to update and modify it.
All right. Here's a voicemail message from Frankie. He wants to know what to expect in the near future.
Hi, Jeff. Hi, Scott. What's crack? Although we will never, ever, ever forget what's going on in Gaza, it will, the conflict will end at some point, and also will Ukraine. So my question is, where next do you think the US will sink its fangs to satisfy its bloodlust? What's the next conflict we can unfortunately expect? Cheers, guys. Keep up the good work.
Thank you. Well, this is why I'm doing not an unprecedented back-to-back Substack, but I rarely hit on the same topic twice. I published, my last Substack was on Georgia Dream, and on this issue of the law. But based upon conversations I've had and conversations are coming out of Georgia, to give you an example, the Georgian president today has basically told the army to rise up against the Georgian Dream government in defense of these protests, which are Western funded. It's an attempted Maidan. She has basically told the army, you know who trained you, you know who funded you, you know what the right thing is to do. That's the fucking president of Georgia committing treason right there. I mean, in any other world, she'd put up against a wall and shot right now. Hint, Georgia Dream, put her up against a wall and shoot her right now, because this is going to get out of control. This is my concern, is that Georgia, the land that I love, the land that my wife is from, is about ready to undergo a civil war. Hundreds of thousands in the streets, blood in the streets. And Georgians aren't that kind of people. I mean, they're lovers, not fighters. They like to drink wine. They're not hookers and jabbers. And the United States and the European Union's going in there, and they're going to destroy this nation. And I'm afraid that that's going to be the next place of massive bloodletting, will be the Republic of Georgia. So I'm hopeful that Georgia Dream can prevail in its current legislation, and that they can suppress the violence that the West is planning. And again, the Georgian president just committed treason. Shoot her. I know I'm not allowed to say that. So when I say shoot her, I mean that figuratively. I don't mean really put her up against the wall, blindfold her, and pull the trigger so bullets penetrate her body and kill her. That's what you would normally do to presidents who urge the military to rise up against the constitutionally mandated government. You would execute them for treason. But I'm not advocating that. I'm saying it's only figurative. She should be held gently in your arms, and you should whisper soft nothings into her ear, telling her to calm down. Everything will be okay.
I mean, I agree with Scott.
All right. Larry C. Johnson agrees with you. So yeah. He's a gentle guy. Very gentle. Very huggable. Tyson in Kiev, or Kiev, as some are wont to say.
The not mayor. Here. Not in this program.
Mayor Klitschko has said that he tried to meet Zelensky in person since February 22nd, but so far he has not succeeded. Is this because Zelensky is isolated, surrounded by the U.S. Special Forces, and is playing the American game, or is there another reason?
Well, Klitschko is a politician who is widely believed to desire to be the president. If you remember back in the day when Victoria Nuland had her phone intercepted, and she's, you know, Yats is our boy. She was also putting down Klitschko, saying that Klitschko's not ready. We don't want Klitschko to be the next leader, the prime minister. We don't want him in power. You're planning against him, that he's better off working on the periphery. Angel, firstly. Yes, Angel, we could, if we're on YouTube, we get thrown off of YouTube, but since we're already thrown off of YouTube, doesn't matter. But I don't want to be seen as promoting violence. But the fact of the matter is that God, Angel, firstly, why did I read your comment? We were talking about Klitschko. Klitschko wants to be president. And it's, you know, it's sort of like, you know, Biden-Trump debating. You know, one side says they want to do it. The other side says they don't want to do it, because we know what the outcome will be. Zelensky does not want to have a meeting with Klitschko, because it'll only put Zelensky in a bad light. It'll only promote Klitschko's, you know, raise his profile. So Zelensky just avoids him to ensure that he doesn't develop the kind of, you know, political following outside of Kiev, 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 you know, that could make him a viable candidate. So I think it's purely for political reasons, just to suppress Klitschko's political profile and, you know, ruin his political ambitions.
Anita in New York, can you explain the phrase "from the river to the sea"? Why is it anti-Semitic? I also heard the Zion Jews in Israel quoting it.
Anita in New York.
Dear sweet Anita.
I'm praying, Anita, that this question was written with purity of heart. Because this is one of those topics that "from the river to the sea" implies from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea and all that's in between. The first people to actually raise it were the Zionists. In fact, the Likud party made it part of their Likud party, whatever the hell they call that thing that they write, that says who we are and what we are. They made a manifesto. And, you know, the implication is that it will be purely Jewish. There will be no Palestinians. And that was their feeling. There should be no Palestinian homeland, no Palestinian state. One from the river to the sea is what Israel will be. Hamas picked up on that and incorporated it into their own charter, implying that, no, there won't be an Israel. It'll be a Palestinian state. So because Hamas did it, and Hamas talked about the violent eradication of the Israeli state, it has become seen as an anti-Semitic trope, although the Netanyahu government today says this and worse about that, but people ignore it because apparently, again, the Palestinians are just human animals. They don't matter. They're not human. So when an Israeli or a Zionist uses it, it's clean, because the only real humans, of course, are the Zionists, are the Israelis, are the Jews. All those Palestinian animals, those human animals in there, they don't matter. They'll be eradicated and moved, and the world won't, you know, blink an eye. But so that's the thing. Both sides have embraced that saying, and the implication is that if you're a Palestinian or a Hamas member and you embrace that, you're saying there will be no Israeli state. If you're an Israeli or a Zionist who embraces it, you're saying there will be no Palestinian state. So either way, it's a phrase that has taken on a negative connotation, because the implication is the side that's citing it is advocating the eradication of the other side.
All right. Here's a somewhat wordy question, but I think I have it in me. I'll take a deep breath. From it. Timochenko in Halifax, Canada. I've lived and worked in Nicaragua during the Contra War and have followed events there since then. During the attempted coup of 2018, there was a tidal wave of social media disinformation being used as part of the coup attempt. Similar tactics used against Venezuela, Bolivia, and the Maidan coup, to name a few examples. How can countries defend themselves from this?
Well, it's actually a good question. You know, back in, I guess, the late Bush years, before Obama became president, there was a young man whose name is escaping me right now, Jared Cohen. And he had traipsed across the Middle East, went to Lebanon, went to Iran, spoke to the youth of the Middle East. And he came back and he wrote a book. And if there's somebody in the chat who can look it up, it ended up being a very well-regarded book about his travels. But the concept was that once you break through all the nonsense about religion and all this stuff, that the youth of the Middle East were the same as the youth of America. Therefore, what they wanted was social media. They wanted internet connectivity. And so he created something he called digital democracy, this term, and he went on to be a player in the Obama State Department. He famously is the one who got Twitter to not shut down the Twitter machine during the Green Revolution in Iran, because the social activities were basically the social media was being used by the opposition to move people around. Facebook was using that to create, you know, movements, et cetera. They did that in Egypt, et cetera. Digital democracy became a thing. And it's something that the United States, together with the CIA and British intelligence, Dutch intelligence is a big player on this. We had a caller from the Netherlands. And then they would get NGOs to front for them. So there's a whole bunch of non-governmental organizations out there that that train activists on how to use social media. In Syria, in the early days, the concept of an oppressive Syrian government was the notion that was created by these Syrian activists who were in committees in each little village and town. And their whole job was to go out there and provoke the Syrian government to doing something, capturing it on film, then getting it out there so that it would be on the internet. And then the mainstream media would pick it up and run with the white helmets. And in Syria also perfected this technique. And we're seeing that technique used over and over again. In every place is a target. They're using it in Georgia right now. They did it in Nicaragua, elsewhere. Digital democracy, it's the ultimate soft power regime. How do you defeat it? I mean, the Iranians defeated by shutting down the internet. They had these big disruptions last year, and the Iranians just hit the master switch. Boom, there it went. And I think that's the solution, is that if you're going to weaponize the internet, then at a time when necessary, governments will just shut down the internet.
Just beat the clock. You are such a pro. Sasha from Russia, specifically St. Petersburg. According to Jake Sullivan, the United States will consider Ukraine a victory if it emerges from the military conflict as a sovereign, democratic, free country. At the same time, he didn't specify where the borders would be following this conflict. What does this mean?
It means that Jake Sullivan is an idiot. I mean, simply put, look, the United States is playing word games. I mean, let's look at those three concepts. It will be sovereign. Is Ukraine a sovereign state today? Was it ever a sovereign state? How do you define sovereignty? The role that the oligarchs played in taking over, how the oligarchs worked with outside economic interests and political interests. Is that a sovereign state? You know, was Zelensky ever a sovereign president? Was he always under the control of the oligarchs? And once he tried to declare independence from the oligarchs, where did his power base come from? Outside powers, the United States, Great Britain. Is it a sovereign state when your ability to pay the pensions and pay the salaries of government officials is totally dependent upon the United States Congress allocating money for you to do this? That's not sovereign. You've lost your sovereignty. You've yielded it, to others. A democratic state. Ukraine's not a democracy. They didn't have elections. On May 20th, Zelensky's term runs out. What happens on May 21st? He's no longer legally Mr. President. Same thing with the Rada, the Ukrainian parliament. The people's representatives aren't represented by any people because the election didn't happen. It's not a democratic state. He's shut down opposition parties. He's taken over the press. He imprisons people who speaks out. The last thing he is a democratic in a free state. You're not a free state when you have to worry about getting thumped on the head and shanghaied off. People are running from Ukraine right now, fleeing Ukraine. The people that fled don't want to come back because they recognize the horror of this war. Ukraine's not a free state. So Jake Sullivan doesn't know what he's talking about. It's just word games, because that's what he is. Let's understand, although he's a national security advisor, Jake Sullivan has no national security experience. I mean, he's not a trained professional. He's a communicator. He's a spinmeister. That's his job, is communication management. He tells stories. He tells narratives. He spends things. But he doesn't know anything about the underlying issues. He's not an expert on anything related to national security. So for him to sit there and say, you know, as long as they meet these three standards is meaningless, because those standards don't exist. The key thing is, by not specifying the borders, the United States is pretty much putting Ukraine on notice that the Zelensky formula, which says that Ukraine goes back to 1991 borders, is never going to happen. That Ukraine is going to have to agree to, at least in the short term, giving up the territory that Russia occupies. And they may have to give up more territory as before this war ends. As people have said, the Russian offensive isn't going to stop, even though this money has been allocated.
Umbridge.
All right, that will do it for this week's episode of the lightning round version of Ask the Inspector, which we do every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time for 1 hour. Please join us Friday night for the loquacious version, when we spend two glorious hours together. Scott answers every question quite extensively, and I provide eye candy for the ladies.
And I promise on Friday to be in a better mood. I will do my best to be in a better mood.
people still find you endearing even when you're a little grumpy. Not that I'm saying you're grumpy, but you say you are. Now, we're going to go to Russia for a few weeks in June, and we are raising funds not only for the trip itself, but to shoot a documentary. So if you would like to donate, you can do that at wagingpeace.fund. Maybe Ryan will flash that on the screen for us. Oh, what a pro. Thank you, Ryan. Also, we're selling some merchandise at scottrittermerch.com. This smart-looking U.S. tour of duty cap that I wear all the time is now on sale. A structured cap, which means you don't have to worry about it being floppy or saggy. It's a high-quality cap. You'll love it. Also, we have T-shirts, Knowledge is Power. We have a coin. We have two coins, actually, with a third one coming. That's the second one. That's the first one. It's an embarrassment of riches. Go to scottrittermerch.com. And as I said earlier, Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika. Would you say that was a wordy book, Scott? That was 600 pages, something like that?
No. That's actually a well-structured book, because my wife was heavily involved in making sure that it wasn't too wordy. And Diana Collier also told me not to put too many words in it. So I was disciplined on that book. I just want to say something about merchandise. I'm uncomfortable selling merchandise for a number of reasons, because I believe in the integrity of the message. And I always get nervous, and Jeff knows this. I mean, look, Jeff and I have had this struggle from day one to the absolute necessity of earning a living. If we're going to commit to something like this, like a podcast, and commit to, you know, trying to do, you know, get the message out there, it's a full-time job. And as a result, we need full-time salaries to pay the bills. That's a requirement. And we've been lucky enough, fortunate enough, that the business model that we've put up allows us to put product out there, the video product, the written product, and not charge, not put a paywall up there. But that is limiting. That's very limiting. You know, at some point in time, we may have to make a decision that something has to go behind a paywall, because bills have to be paid. But the other thing about merchandise is you just never want to cheapen something so that people think that the whole purpose of what you're doing is just a front to sell merchandise. And so I just want to reiterate what Jeff said. Whatever merchandise we sell, I mean, we're going to try and, I mean, like Jeff said, good quality hat. We're not trying to sell cheap shit. But there's a purpose behind it. We are in June going to be going off for a very lengthy trip. That is very ambitious. And it is the third leg of a trilogy of trips that in the combination comprise the Waging Peace Project, which is an important project to help defeat Russophobia and promote good relations between the United States and Russia. And a lot of people say that they believe in this project. The movie that we're going to make, the documentary, is going to be high quality, and we hope we'll do a very good job of not only capturing the experience here, but also have a message that helps empower people with knowledge and information. The movie doesn't happen for free. To give people an example, back in 2000, 2001, I made a film called In Shifting Sands. The budget for that movie ended up being $475,000, which at the time was a steal. People told me that I couldn't make the movie under $500,000. I was $25,000 under it. Today, you know, here we are, a quarter of a century later. I'm just here to tell you that things don't get cheaper over time. They get more expensive. And for us to do a project like this, there is a budget, and that budget is real. It became more real than I possibly knew, because Jeff and I had a conversation with a professional who hopefully will help us out. And when the number came in, I was like, what the? We can use that word. I was just blown away, because I wasn't ready for that number. But the more I've gone out and looked at and researched and all that, the more I'm realizing is, God damn it, that's the price you got to pay to do work like that today if you want to do quality work. And so we need help. And that's why I'm not opposed. In fact, I'm actually helping promote merchandise here. I think that, you know, we can have something that people can hold on to and feel like they contributed to, to this project, this project of WGP. It's not just the movie. The movie is one manifestation of it. We are planning to do a book that will be published both in Russian and English that captures this experience. There'll be other things. It opens the door for other opportunities. One of the things we're looking to do with this Waging Peace project is to create pen pals between Russians and Americans so that the conversations that we initiate on this trip continue and lead to a better understanding between peoples, so that someday when I'm old and rocking on a chair, me and Jeff are sitting next to each other drinking mint juleps, we can sit there and go, God damn it, boy, we did something. The sun is setting today. And so we don't have to, we can listen to Roger Waters' Two Suns in the Sunset and go, that didn't happen because we did something. We worked with people to make the world a better place, and Russia and America didn't go to war with one another. That's sort of the future I want. But it doesn't happen on its own volition. We are starting the process, and we need your help. I'm just being straight up honest about that whatever help you can provide is grateful, but I just want you to know, first of all, if you can't, that's okay. I understand that. But I don't want people to misconstrue the merchandise aspect of it. We're not here to try and fuck you over. We're not here blowing smoke up your ass and trying to enrich ourselves with merchandise. That's not what's happening here. This isn't a bait and switch operation. Whatever merchandise we put up there is stuff that we hope has a tie to not just the program, but to the project. And I want you to know that if you buy the merchandise, that money will go to the project. The project is Jeff. The project is me. The project is Ryan. The project is Wiley, if we bring her on. The project is people. But the project is also a documentary film, video blogs, a book, and the chance to all of us be 80 years old in a rocking chair drinking mint juleps saying, God damn it, we did something that saved the world.
I got into a conversation a couple of nights ago with a couple of lovely women who were visiting Wilmington from New York. And we got to talking about the pen pal idea, and they thought it was great. And one of them, who lives in Long Island, said she knows farmers, and she's going to see if she can get some Long Island farmers to agree to have that pen pal thing going with farmers in Russia. So I'm working on it, Scott. Also, I want to say that not only are we lucky to be getting some monetary contributions, and we need a lot more, as Scott said, but we also have people who are donating their services. And I won't say his name because I don't know if he wants to be anonymous or not. But as I said earlier, we're about to launch a new website. Very talented, nice guy, has donated his services and has put a lot of time and effort into it, and I appreciate that very much. Somebody bought scottritter.com for us also.
For not me.
$5 million. I don't even know how much they
spent. I don't know.
when the website's done, I will be acknowledging him by name. He already said it'd be okay. Thanks to Ryan Milton for sitting in today. We appreciate it. Thanks to our beloved audience. Thanks to Scott. Don't forget tomorrow night, Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, the Scott Ritter Show on Rumble, Twitch, X, and Locals. And we'll be back for Ask the Inspector on Friday night. Take care, everybody.